Previously on Under Our Feet.
But his genius was not finding this white powder. The fact that he looked at its properties and discovered it didn't dissolve in anything, it didn't react with anything, it was impervious to a lot of stuff. This was essentially PTFE or Teflon. That's how Teflon got discovered.
We learned about the history of PFAS forever chemicals, how they were developed in a lab accident in the 1930s while scientists were trying to make safer refrigerants. By the 1960s, the miracle chemicals were everywhere.
PFAS are great because they are heat resistant, water resistant, oil resistant, and really stable.
But it's not all sunshine and roses. By the early 2000s, regulators and the public began to realize just how harmful these things are.
Clearly, increased cholesterol, two specific kinds of cancer, kidney and testicular. Effects on pregnant women, increased hypertension, blood pressure, effects on fetal growth, and effects on the immune system. Decreased response to vaccines.
In recent years, we've also begun to realize just how pervasive they are in our bodies.
We know that 98% of people have it in their blood.
In this episode, we start the journey that PFAS chemicals take from places they're supposed to be, like your Gore-Tex raincoat or in a firefighting foam, to places they're not supposed to be, like your blood. That's coming up.
PFOS.
PFOA.
PFMOPRA.
PFMOBA.
PFHPA.
ADONA.
PFDOA.
PFECA.
FDS622.
FDS422.
PFHPS.
PFDA.
TREA.
PFNA.
PFNA.
PFPES.
PFTRIA.
PFDS. PFHXA.
PFHXS.
Welcome to Under Our Feet, the podcast where we go deep into time and deep into the earth to discover the geologic forces and events that shape the world around us. I'm your host, Rudy Molinick, and in this season, we're digging into the history of PFAS forever chemicals, their impacts, and the hidden systems that move them around our world and into the water that comes out of your tap. As a reminder, make sure to check out our website, uofpod.org, for more info. If you want to support the work I do on this show, there's a link on the website for our Patreon page. There, you can give as little as $1 a month to get shoutouts on the show and some cool merch like bumper stickers and t-shirts. Thanks to Nate Stevens, Emma Goodman, and Nini Cormier for their recent support. In this episode, we're going to take a little trip. We'll follow some imaginary shipments of PFAS chemicals from the factory and trace how they wind their way through our world to end up all around us and in our bodies. One barrel of this steaming fresh PFAS is shipped off to factories and put into consumer goods. You remember from the last episode what these are.
They're used in firefighting foams.
In your Teflon pan.
You know, waterproof fabrics, Gore-Tex boots.
Microwave popcorn bags or fast food wrappers.
So they're everywhere.
Think about that for a second. Where do all these consumer goods end up? In the landfill. Now, you might imagine a landfill is just a hole in the ground where we dump our trash. I certainly did before I started researching this episode. But it turns out that's a bit outdated.
But they're not the dumps of when I was a kid, when they truly were a hole in the ground where you threw things in them. And that caused, you know, extensive groundwater contamination throughout the United States and really severe health impacts on communities. And we learned our lesson the hard way on that in the 70s and developed RCRA, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which has been in place since 1976 and has driven a whole revolution in the way we manage waste.
This is Craig Benson, a professor emeritus of engineering at the University of Wisconsin and a former dean of engineering at the University of Virginia. He's a longtime geoenvironmental engineer.
It's somewhere a cross between a geological engineer, an environmental engineer, and a hydrologist. And it's the people in my field work at the intersection of the natural and built environments, and with the objective of protecting our subsurface resources that we all depend on for life.
In this case, the intersection of the natural and built environment is located at the bottom of a landfill, which, it turns out, is actually a highly engineered space.
During my career, you know, we really evolved from dumps, holes in the ground, to highly sophisticated engineering containment facilities where we place waste and we surround it with barriers so that the liquids and gases that are generated by that waste don't get into our water and don't get into our air. I spent a lot of my career figuring out, how do you build those barriers? You know, how do you make a liner? How do you make a cover? Liners keep the liquid in and keep it from dripping down into groundwater. Covers keep the water out that generates liquid that gets contaminated, and also helps us capture the gases as well.
But it's unrealistic and really impossible to keep all rainwater out of landfills and all the wastewater that's already inside trapped in the landfill forever. Water will always get in, and eventually it will leak out, no matter what kind of liner people like Craig dream up. So the goal is to channel that flow of water and try to control it.
There's a whole issue of if we've got this liquid in there, how do we collect it? How do we treat it? And make sure we do that in a way that doesn't have other unintended impacts as well.
These days, a big one of those unintended impacts is from PFAS.
All the things that go in the landfill that have PFAS, which is, you know, just ubiquitous number of products from, you know, floor polish to shoe polish to cosmetics to pizza boxes, you name it, it's got PFAS in it, clothing, carpet, furniture, all of which is in the landfill. If you go visit a landfill, you'll see a community history on display.
Since the 1960s, that community history is certainly chock full of PFAS. So it starts to rain over the landfill. That pleasant sprinkle seeps through the layers of our ephemera. Along its path, as it works our way through our trash, the water is leaching out minute amounts of chemicals and other nasty stuff. By the time it reaches the bottom of the dump, it's something of a toxic stew. This is where the new landfill engineering that Craig was mentioning becomes really important. Instead of just seeping into the soil and thus escaping the containment of the landfill, this water, it hits a barrier.
Well, the liner is really one of the key evolutions that happened in landfill technology over the last 50 years. So a modern liner typically will have a clay component, which is a natural mineral material that we place very deliberately to have very low hydraulic conductivity, or meaning essentially being impermeable. But they're never truly impermeable because it's a porous material, low conductivity, but not impermeable. And so when you take even something that transmits water at a low rate and you put it over a large area, it's still a lot of water, right? And a lot of contaminants. So actually, if we layer a piece of plastic on top of the clay, that's called a geomembrane, just polyethylene, same stuff you make little toys out of, just tough plastic. And that material then essentially creates a nearly impermeable barrier. But I can never put it in perfectly. It always has holes in it, right? So the two work together, the clay and the plastic. The plastic's nearly impermeable. It cuts down the area of flow dramatically, but it always has holes. And wherever those holes are, that's where my clay is, backing it up.
But as I said earlier, the goal is not to keep all the water safely ensconced in the landfill forever. Even with the best liners Craig could ever engineer, with clay and geomembranes, something would start to leak out. Knowing this, though, gives engineers like Craig a chance to get ahead of the problem. They can capture the water.
Yeah, sure. You pump it out. Often it will go to a big tank at the landfill, a HH storage tank. And then periodically, depending on where the location is, you might have that tanker trucks come up to that tank and decant it from the tank, put it in a truck, and then that truck would deliver the leachate to a wastewater treatment plant, the same thing that treats your sewage, right? that same plant will often treat landfill leachate. If you're in a more of an urban community, you might actually have a pipeline straight from the landfill to the wastewater treatment plant.
I think every part of this waste system is something I used to take just totally for granted, like the water that comes out when I turn on my tap. Every week a big truck comes and takes away my trash, just like clockwork. Every time I flush my toilet or wash my dishes, that dirty water just disappears. But I guess disappears is really kind of the wrong word. Rather, my trash and wastewater enter the complex flow of a highly engineered waste stream. And that system is way bigger than our household waste. At the landfill, there's a convergence from
industry, it comes from government, it comes from your office, it comes from your home. It's anything that's no longer being used or has value and needs to go somewhere.
At the wastewater treatment plant, it's a similar story.
It's really not just sewage from your home, but it's the wastewater from your office and the wastewater from the manufacturing plant and from the airport and everything else that goes into that same waste stream.
So we're now at the wastewater treatment plant, and that barrel of PFAS we started with was put into a bunch of things, food wrappers, piano keys, raincoats, carpet protectants, you name it. Those things, we eventually threw them out. Then in the landfill, they reacted with rainwater so that PFAS leached into the water. Then that water was pumped and piped or trucked to be treated along with all the rest of our societal effluents. And haven't you always wondered what magic happens in that mysterious place where pretty nasty water from landfills and our toilets goes in and clean water comes out? Well, here's a hint. It's definitely not magic.
At that plant, they'll use physical and biological processes to remove the contaminants from the water. And as it goes through that plant, you tend to separate, you know, the wastewater has got a lot of stuff in it. And one of the primary things you do is separate the solids from the liquids, right? And you, some of that's just inert solids, some of it's organic solids, but we will essentially like precipitate that out. You imagine you'll get a sludge that develops, and that there's actually activated sludge treatment processes, a biological treatment of the water that actually creates more sludge. And ultimately, all that sludge needs to go somewhere.
These days, that sludge often goes back to the landfill, where it starts the process of leaching and treatment all over again. But not that long ago, it was super common to take the treated sludge and spread it on farm fields as fertilizer. They called it biosolids. Well, oops. But what about the other part of the equation, the supposedly clean water that's left behind when the sludge is removed?
One more thing that's important. You know, that water, the clean water that goes out the end, it's not perfectly clean. And I think this is an important point. And actually removing PFAS from wastewater treatment plants is hard. Really, even 5 years ago, we had no regulations on PFAS. Just really wasn't on anybody's mind. You know, a couple academic scientists working on things, you know, maybe somebody here and there. And then all of a sudden, we've got this emerging contaminant, and these seem to come up about every two decades. And we have PCBs, and then chlorinated solvents, and now we have PFAS.
The trick, then, for modern landfill managers and treatment plant engineers is how to efficiently and profitably deal with these new contaminants as we become aware of them.
But we also have treatment processes at wastewater plants, which has been our conventional pathway, that aren't always effective in doing that, right? And so the big question is, one, how much PFAS do I have? What's the best way to manage it? Should I be sending it off to a leachate treatment plant? What if my treatment plant says, I'm not taking any more of your leachate, right? What do I do then? It's not like the landfill stops generating leachate. I got to have a solution. So these are kind of the issues that industry is grappling with, is how much of this do we have? What's the best way to treat it? Where can we treat it? What's the cost of treatment going to be? You know, these are businesses, right? They have employees. They have to make a profit, or they just don't function. And these are the big challenges.
Challenges that a lot of really smart folks are still trying to solve, because right now, that PFAS is pretty much just escaping the treatment plant and the landfill.
And so some of it gets lost, right? It goes out with the clean water, goes into the river. We have lots of issues with rivers that have PFAS in them from wastewater treatment plants. That's the leak, right? That's one of the leaks. So that's this loop that's going back to the landfill. I take the PFAS back with the sludge, but I lost some of it and went into the river. And I also lost some when it leaked out of my liner and into groundwater.
Okay. So if we go back to the start, we were following two shipments of fresh PFAS chemicals. That was the first. It was put into a bunch of consumer and household goods, which eventually ended up in the landfill. In the landfill, all those objects interact with rainwater and some of the PFAS leaches out. In the highly engineered modern landfill, we collect that leachate water and send it to the wastewater treatment plant, where we do our best to filter out all the bad stuff. But with newly recognized contaminants like PFAS, two things happen. Some slips through the filtering processes and ends up in the clean water at the end. The rest is caught in the sludge at the water treatment plant, taken out of the water, and sent right back to the landfill, where it restarts what Craig calls the leaky loop. Okay, what about that other shipment of brand new PFAS? The second barrel of PFAS winds its way to remote northern Wisconsin. As it nears the shores of Lake Michigan's Green Bay, the truck turns into a break in the woods and arrives at the Tyco Firefighting Foam Manufacturing and Testing Facility. It turns out PFAS make a really good foam for putting out unconventional fires, the ones that don't go out easily with just straight up water. Think like an electrical fire on a Navy ship or a plane with jet fuel burning out on a runway. The PFAS, because of those unique chemical properties we talked about in the last episode, helps form a dense foam to choke off intense fires from the necessary heat and oxygen that they need to keep burning. They call those foams AFFFs, or aqueous film forming foam. For decades, that company up in northern Wisconsin has been a primary producer of these necessary and even miraculous PFAS firefighting foams. But they didn't just make the foam and pack it up and ship it off in neat boxes to Navy shipyards and airport fire departments. Something else was going on out in the Northwoods, in Peshtigo, right out in the open.
Well, there is the Fire Technology Center, the Fire Training Center, that has had a variety of names, actually, since I was growing up. It was Ansel, and then Tyco and Johnson Controls bought it, and which is why now we just refer to it as Tyco Johnson Controls. And they had been open ground testing with AFFF firefighting foam, which contains PFAS, for decades.
You know, the industry knowingly open ground tested this stuff for decades while warning their customers upon selling it not to test with it on open ground.
Years and years and years, decades of massive profits from selling to both commercially and to the military firefighting foam with PFAS in it. You would test your stuff and let it wash into the environment next to your testing pad outside.
That was Kayla Furton, Cindy Boyle, and Doug Oitzinger, who all live near the facility. Here's what happened from another local resident, Jeff Lamont.
There's a fire training center that had been in existence here for about 65 years. And it's a international fire training center. So they would fly people in from airports all over the world, a lot of different DOD, you know, the Navy, the Air Force, you know, whoever flew planes. And they would train them on this 320-acre facility, which is about as the crow flies, maybe 3/4 of a mile up gradient of us. And what they would do is they would ignite thousands of gallons of accelerant, and these people that were training would have to put it out with the AFFF foams. And of course, once they extinguished it and the training exercise was over, they'd come out with big fire hoses and wash all the foam down in the streams and the creeks that run through the property. So this training was done on just open ground, no containment whatsoever.
So, for decades, people from all over the world came out to Peshtigo to train on how to use these AFFF firefighting foams. After each session, out come the water hoses, and they wash the residue off the concrete training pad and into a drainage ditch. And that is the start of the contaminant's journey. A similar thing has happened at every airport that's had a plane on fire on the runway or where they've trained with these foams. In Wisconsin, two of the big examples of this are at the airports near La Crosse and Rhinelander. At La Crosse, even though the use of PFAS to put out a plane fire was over 20 years ago, residents still have toxic levels of PFAS in their well water. So imagine just how bad it is in Peshtigo, where the practice was ongoing for decades. In addition to this acute source of contamination, we've also heard this episode about challenges in the waste stream, both at landfills and wastewater treatment plants, and the ways PFAS can escape these containment systems through really small leaks, incomplete or inadequate filtration, and even using that leftover treated sludge called biosolids as an agricultural fertilizer. But these are all just starting points. It's the initial time where PFAS gets out of where it's supposed to be and is introduced to the environment. From here, it now has to travel through the earth and in our surface waters to end up in the water we drink.
I said, by the way, I don't think you should be using that pump to water the garden because of the contamination from Johnson Controls or Tyco.
One drop of PFAS can contaminate an Olympic-sized swimming pool, but one Olympic-sized swimming pool of PFAS can contaminate like the entire U.S. groundwater supply seven times over or something like that. And there's certainly been more than one Olympic-sized swimming pool of PFAS produced.
In Wisconsin, groundwater and surface water are really connected. So the water infiltrates, and then it moves in the subsurface.
That's next time on Under Our Feet. Thanks for listening. If you liked what you heard, leave us a rating or review. If you really liked it, support us on Patreon. The money I get there helps me get what I need to create and publish the show. I couldn't do it without you. There's a link to Patreon on our website, uofpod.org. There you can also find old episodes and more information, like my email address. Feel free to be in touch. The music you're hearing, and all the music you've heard this episode and this season, is by the Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Chris Zahasky and his PFAS seminar at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for recording the PFAS acronyms you heard at the beginning of this and every episode. And thanks to everyone who I've interviewed this season to put it all together, as well as to Latif Nasser, who gave advice on interviewing and helped refine the story. And thanks to you all, most of all, and see you next time.